name with his work, home, and pager number printed in black block letters. I set my gun down where I could reach it fast, and dialed his home number first.
You have reached the home of Dr. Daryl Zhao. You may leave a message after the tone, or call his pager at 543.
Daryl's bassy rumble sounded intimate, despite the impersonal message. I hung up and tried his work number, but he wasn't there either. I'd started dialing his pager, but while I'd been trying to call him, I'd been thinking about our encounter last night. "This isn't the time," he told Ben. I hadn't given it a second thought last night, but had there been a special emphasis in his voice? Had he meant, as I'd assumed, not after all the effort Ben had put into being on his best behavior since his banishment from London? Or had it been more specific, as in, "Not now, when we have greater matters to deal with. Greater matters, like killing the Alpha." In Europe, murder was still mostly the way the rule of the pack changed hands. The old Alpha ruled until one of the younger, hungrier, dominant males decided the old one had grown weak and attacked him. I knew of at least one European Alpha who killed any male who showed signs of being dominant. In the New World, thanks to the iron hand of the Maroc, things were more civilized. Leadership was mostly imposed from above, and no one challenged the Maroc's decisions, at least not as long as I had known him. But could someone have come into Adam's house and done this much damage without help from Adam's pack? I hung up the phone and stared at the list of names, none of whom I dared call for help until I knew more about what was going on. My gaze dropped and rested on a photograph in a wooden frame set out beside the list. A younger Jessie grinned at me with a baseball bat over her shoulder and a cap pulled a little to one side. Jessie. I snatched up my rifle and sprinted up the stairs to her room. She wasn't there. I couldn't tell if there had been a struggle in it or not. Jessie tended to live in a tumult that reflected itself in the way she kept her room. In coyote form, my senses are stronger. So I hid both of my guns under her bed, stripped out of my clothes, and changed. Jessie's scent was all over the room, but I also caught a hint of the human who'd confronted Mac at my garage last night. I followed the trail of his scent down the stairs, because Jessie's scent was too prevalent to find a single trail. I was almost out the door when a sound stopped me in my tracks. I temporarily abandoned the trail to investigate. At first I thought perhaps I had only heard one of the pieces of overturned furniture settling, but then I noticed Adam's left front paw had moved. Once I saw that, I realized I could hear the almost imperceptible sound of his breathing. Maybe it was only the sharper senses of the coyote, but I would have sworn he hadn't been breathing earlier. If he was alive, there was a very good chance he'd stay that way. Werewolves are tough. I whined happily, crawled over the wreckage of his table, and licked his bloody face once before resuming my search for his daughter. Adam's house is at the end of a dead-end road. Directly in front of his house is a turnaround. The SUV I'd seen take off, presumably with Jessie, had left a short trail of burning rubber, but most cars have very little individual scent until they grow old. This one had not left enough behind for me to trail once the tang of burnt rubber faded from its tires. There was no more trail to follow. Nothing I could do for Jessie. Nothing I could do for Mac. I turned my attention to Adam. That he was alive meant I really could not contact his pack, not with him helpless. If any of the dominants had aspirations to become Alpha, they'd kill him. I also couldn't just bring him to my house. First, as soon as someone realized he was missing, they'd check my place out. Second, a badly wounded werewolf was dangerous to himself and everyone around him. Even if I could trust his wolves, there was no dominant in the Columbia Basin pack strong enough to keep Adam's wolf under control until he was well enough to control himself. I knew where one was, though. Chapter 5. A Vanagon resembles nothing so much as a Twinkie on wheels, a 15-foot-long, 6-foot-wide Twinkie with as much aerodynamic styling as a barn door. In the 12 years that VW imported them into the U.S., they never put anything bigger in them than the 4-cylinder Wasserboxer engine. My 1989 four-wheel drive, 4,000-pound Syncros engine put out a whopping 90 horses. In layman's terms, that meant I was cruising up the interstate with a dead body and a wounded werewolf at 60 miles an hour. Downhill, with a good tailwind, the van could go 75. Uphill, I was lucky to make 50. I could have pushed it a little faster, but only if I wanted to chance blowing my engine altogether. For some reason, the thought of being stranded by the roadside with my current cargo was enough to keep my foot off the gas pedal. The highway stretched out before me in gentle curves that were mostly empty of traffic or scenic beauty, unless you liked scrub desert better than I did. I didn't want to think of Mac, or of Jesse scared and alone, or of Adam, who might be dying because I chose to move him rather than call his pack. So I took out my cell phone. I called my neighbors first. Dennis Cather was a retired pipe fitter, and his wife Anna, a retired nurse. They'd moved in 2 years ago and adopted me after I fixed their tractor. "Yes?" Anna's voice was so normal after the morning I'd had, it took me a moment to answer. "Sorry to call you so early," I told her, "but I've been called out of town on a family emergency. I shouldn't be gone long, just a day or two, but I didn't check to make sure Medea had food and water."
"Don't fret, dear," she said. "We'll look after her. I hope that it's nothing serious."
I couldn't help but glance back at Adam in the rearview mirror. He was still breathing. "It's serious. One of my foster family is hurt."
"You go take care of what you need to," she said briskly. "We'll see to things here."
It wasn't until after I cut the connection that I wondered if I had involved them in something dangerous. Mac had been left on my doorstep for a reason, a warning to keep my nose out of someone's business, and I was most certainly sticking my whole head in it now. I was doing as much as I could for Adam, and I thought of something I could do for Jesse. I called Z. Zebold Adelbert Smiter, Z for short, had taught me everything I knew about cars. Most Fey are very sensitive to iron, but Z was a Metalsauber, which is a rather broad category name given to the few Fey who could handle metal of all kinds. Z preferred the modern American term, gremlin, which he felt better fit his talents. I wasn't calling him for his talents, but for his connections.
"Yeah," said a gruff male voice.
"Hey, Z, it's Mercy. I have a favor to ask."
"Yeah, sure, Liebling," he said. "What's up?"
I hesitated. Even after all this time, the rule of keeping pack trouble in the pack was hard to break, but Z knew everyone in the Fey community. I outlined the past day to him as best I could.
"So you think this baby werewolf of yours brought this trouble here? Then why did they take our kleiner Jesse?"
"I don't know," I said. "I'm hoping that when Adam recovers, he'll know something more."
"So you are asking me to see if anyone I know has seen these strange wolves in hopes of finding Jesse?"
"There were at least 4 werewolves moving into the Tri-Cities. You'd think that someone among the Fey would have noticed." Because the Tri-Cities was so close to the Walla Walla Fey Reservation, there were more Fey living here than was usual.
"Yeah," Z agreed heavily. "You'd think. I will ask around. Jesse is a good girl. She should not be in these evil men's hands longer than we can help."
"If you go by the garage, would you mind putting a note in the window?" I asked. "There's a close for the holiday sign under the counter in the office."
"You think they might come after me if I opened it for you?" he asked.
Z often ran the garage if I had to be out of town.
"You may be right. Yeah, gut. I'll open the garage today and tomorrow."
It had been a long time since Zebold Adelbert Schmeiter of the Black Forest had been sung about. So long that those songs had faded from memory. But there was something of the spirit of the Heldenlieder, the old German hero songs, about him still. "A werewolf doesn't need a sword or gun to tear you to bits," I said, unable to leave it alone, though I knew better than to argue with the old gremlin once he'd made up his mind. "Your metalworking magic won't be much help against one." He snorted.
"Don't you worry about me, Liebling. I was killing werewolves when this country was still a Viking colony."
Many of the lesser Fae talked about how old they were, but Z had told me that most of them shared a lifespan similar to humankind. Z was a lot older than that. I sighed and gave in. "All right, but be careful. If you're going to be there, I have a parts order that should be in. Could you check it for me? I haven't ordered from this place before, but my usual source was out.
Jawohl. Leave it to me.
The next call I made was to Stefan's answering machine. Hey, Stefan, I told it. This is Mercy. I'm headed to Montana today. I don't know when I'll be back. Probably late this week. I'll give you a call. I hesitated, but there really wasn't a good way to say the next part. I had to haul a dead body in your van. It's fine. Elizaveta Arkadyevna cleaned it. I'll explain when I get back. Mentioning Elizaveta reminded me of something else I needed to do. Adam's house was on the end of the road, but it was clearly visible from the river. Someone would notice that the couch was sitting in the flower beds and call the police if the mess wasn't cleaned up soon. I had her number on my phone, though I'd never had occasion to use it before. I got her answering machine and left a message telling her there was a mess at Adam's house, there had been a dead man on my porch, Jesse was missing, and I was taking Adam, who was wounded, somewhere he'd be safe. Then I closed the phone and put it away. I didn't know what happened at Adam's house, but that didn't stop me from feeling guilty and responsible. If I hadn't interfered last night when the two bullies came to find Mac, would everyone still be alive? If I'd sent Mac to Montana, to the Maroc, rather than letting Adam take him, what would that have changed? Taking Mac to the Maroc had never even occurred to me. I hadn't contacted Brand since he'd sent me away from the pack, and he'd returned the favor. I took a quick glance behind my seat at the blue tarp concealing Mac's body. Well, I was bringing Mac to him now. I found myself remembering the shy grin Mac had worn when I told him my name. I wiped my cheeks and fiercely blinked back further tears, but it was no use. I cried for him, for his parents and his brother who didn't even know he was dead. Doubtless they were all sitting beside their phones, waiting for him to call again. I was coming down the grade into Spokane before more pressing worries distracted me from grief and guilt. Adam began stirring. My fear that Adam would die was instantly overwhelmed by the worry that he'd heal too fast. I still had well over 200 miles to go, most of it two-lane mountain highway meandering through dozens of small towns at 25 miles an hour. The last 60 miles was on a road marked Other on the state highway map, as opposed to highway or road. As I recalled, it was gravel most of the way. I figured it would take me at least 4 more hours. Dominant wolves heal faster than the submissive wolves. By my rough estimate, it would be no more than 2 days before Adam was recovered enough to control his wolf, which would be capable of mayhem long before that. I needed Bran before Adam was mobile, and if he was stirring already, I was going to be lucky if I made it. When I hit Coeur d'Alene, where I'd have to leave the interstate for highway, I gassed up, then drove to the first fast-food burger place I found and bought 30 cheeseburgers. The bemused teenager who started handing me bags through the service window peered curiously at me. I didn't explain, and she couldn't see my passengers because of the van's curtains. I parked in the restaurant's parking lot, snatched a couple of the bags, stepped over Mac, and began stripping the buns off the meat. Adam was too weak to do more than growl at me and snatch the cheese and ketchup-covered meat as fast as I could toss it to him. He ate almost 20 patties before he subsided into his previous coma-like state. The first few flakes of snow began falling on us as I took the highway north. I drove into Troy, Montana, cursing the heavy wet snow that had distracted me so I missed my turnoff, which should have been several miles earlier. I topped off my gas tank, got directions, chained up, and headed back the way I'd come. The snow was falling fast enough that the snow crews hadn't been able to keep up with it. The tracks of the cars preceding me were rapidly filling. The gas station clerk's directions freshened my mind. I slowed as I crossed back over the Yak River. It was a baby river compared to the Kootenay, which I'd been driving next to for the past few hours. I watched the side of the road carefully, and it was a good thing I did. The small green sign that marked the turnoff was half covered in wet snow. There was only one set of tracks up the road. They turned off at a narrow drive, and after that I found my way up the road by driving where there were no trees. Happily, the trees were dense and marked the way pretty clearly. The road twisted up and down the narrow river valley, and I was grateful for the four-wheel drive. Once a couple of black-tailed deer darted in front of me. They gave me an irritated glance and trotted off. It had been a long time since I'd been that way. I hadn't even had my driver's license then. The road was unfamiliar, and I began to worry I'd miss my turn. The road divided, one half clearly marked, but the other half, the one I had to take, was barely wide enough for my van. "Well," I told Adam, who was whining restlessly, "if we end up in Canada and you haven't eaten me yet, I suppose we can turn around, come back, and try again." I'd about decided I was going to have to do just that when I topped a long grade and saw a hand-carved wooden sign. I stopped the van. "Aspen Creek," the sign read in graceful script, carved and painted white on a dark brown background. 23 miles. As I turned the van to follow the arrow, I wondered when Bran had decided to allow someone to post a sign. Maybe he'd gotten tired of having to send out guides, but he'd been adamant about keeping a low profile when I left. I don't know why I expected everything to be the same. After all, I'd changed a good deal in the years since I'd last been there. I should have expected that Aspen Creek would have changed, too. I didn't have to like it. The uninitiated would be forgiven for thinking there were only 4 buildings in Aspen Creek: the gas station post office, the school, the church, and the motel. They wouldn't see the homes tucked unobtrusively up the draws and under the trees. There were a couple of cars in front of the gas station, but otherwise the whole town looked deserted. I knew better. There were always people watching, but they wouldn't bother me unless I did something unusual, like dragging a wounded werewolf out of my van. I stopped in front of the motel office, just under the Aspen Creek Motel sign, which bore more than a passing resemblance to the sign I'd followed to town. The old motel was built the way the motor hotels had been in the middle of the last century, a long, narrow, and no-frills building designed so guests could park their vehicles in front of their rooms. There was no one in the office, but the door was unlocked. It had been updated since I'd been there last, and the end result was rustic charm, which was better than the run-down 1950s tacky it had been. I hopped over the front desk and took a key marked No. 1. No. 1 was the Maroc's safe room, specially designed to contain uncooperative werewolves. I found a piece of paper and a pen and wrote, "Wounded in No. 1. Please do not disturb." I left the note on the desk where it couldn't be missed, then I returned to the van and backed it up to the room. Getting Adam out of the van was going to be rough no matter what. At least when I dragged him into it, he'd been unconscious. I opened the reinforced metal door of the motel room and took a look around. The furnishing was new but sparse, just a bed and a nightstand that was permanently fixed against the wall. Nothing to help me get a werewolf who weighed twice what I did out of the van and into the room without hurting one or the other of us. There was no porch, as there had been at Adam's house, which left almost a 4-foot drop from the back of the van to the ground. In the end, I decided calling for help was better than hurting Adam worse. I went back to the office and picked up the phone. I hadn't called Sam's number since I'd left, but some things are just ingrained. Even though he was the reason I'd left here, he was the first one I thought to call for help. "Hello?" answered a woman's voice that sounded completely unfamiliar. I couldn't speak. I hadn't realized how much I'd been counting on hearing Samuel until I heard someone else's voice instead. "Marley, is there something wrong at the motel? Do you need me to send Carl?" She must have caller ID, I thought stupidly. She sounded frantic, but I recognized her voice at last and felt a wave of relief. I don't know why Lisa Stovall was answering this number, but the mention of Carl and the sudden tension in her voice cued me in. I guess she had just never sounded cheerful when she talked to me. Some things might have changed, but some things I had just forgotten. Aspen Creek had a population of about 500 people, and only about 70 were werewolves, but I seldom thought about the human majority. Lisa and her husband Carl were both human. So was Marley, at least she had been when I left. She'd also been about 6 years old. "I don't know where Marley is," I told her. "This is Mercedes, Mercedes Thompson. There's no one in the motel office. I'd really appreciate it if you'd send Carl down here or tell me who else to call. I have the Alpha from the Columbia Basin pack in my van. He's badly wounded, and I need help getting him into the motel room. Even better would be if you could tell me how to get a hold of Bran. Bran didn't have a telephone at his home, or hadn't when I left. For all I knew, he had a cell phone now. Lisa, like most of the women of Aspen Creek, had never liked me. But she wasn't one of those people who let a little thing like that get in the way of doing what was right and proper. Bran and some of the others have taken the new wolves out for their first hunt. Marley's probably holed up somewhere crying. Lee, her brother, was one of the ones who tried to change. He didn't make it. I'd forgotten. How could I have forgotten? The last full moon of October, all of those who chose to try to become werewolves were allowed to come forward. In a formal ceremony, they were savaged by Bran or by some other wolf who loved them, in the hopes that they would rise, changed. Most of them didn't make it. I remembered the tension that gripped the town through October and the sadness of November. Thanksgiving had a different meaning to the residents of Aspen Creek than it did for the rest of America. "I'm sorry," I said inadequately, feeling rawly incapable of dealing with more dead youngsters. I remembered Lee, too. "Lee was a good kid." "I'll send Carl." Lisa's voice was crisp, denying me the right to grieve or sympathize. She hung up without saying goodbye. I avoided thinking or looking at the tarp that covered Mac while I sat in the van waiting for help. Instead, I fed Adam the remaining hamburgers while we waited. They were cold and congealed, but it didn't seem to bother the wolf. When they were gone, he closed his eyes and ignored me. At long last, Carl pulled up next to me in a beat-up Jeep and climbed out. He was a big man, and had always been more of a man of action than words. He hugged me and thumped me on my back.
"Don't be such a stranger, Mercy," he said, then laughed at my look of shock and ruffled my hair.
I'd forgotten he liked to do that, forgotten the easy affection he showed to everyone, even Bran.
"Lisa said you have Adam here and he's in bad shape?"
Of course he'd know who the alpha of the Columbia Basin pack was. Adam's pack was closest to Aspen Creek. I nodded and opened the back of my van so he could see what we were dealing with. Adam looked better than he had when I first put him in the van, but that wasn't saying much. I couldn't see the bones of his ribs anymore, but his coat was matted with blood and covered with wounds. Carl whistled through his teeth, but all he said was,
"We'll need to tie his jaws shut until we get him in. I've got something we can use in the Jeep."
He brought an ace bandage, and we wound it round and round Adam's muzzle. The wolf opened his eyes once, but didn't struggle. It took a lot of grunting, a few swear words, and a little sweat, but the two of us managed to get Adam out of the van and into the room. Once we had him on the bed, I made Carl get back before I unwound the bandage and freed the wolf. I was fast, but even so, Adam caught my forearm with an eye tooth and drew blood. I jumped back as he rolled off his side and struggled to stand, driven to defend himself against the pain we'd caused him.
"Out," Carl said, holding the door for me.
I complied, and we shut the door behind us. Carl held it shut while I turned the key in the deadbolt. Unlike most motel rooms, this deadbolt operated by key from both sides, for just such situations. The windows were barred, the vents sealed. Number one served as prison and hospital on occasion, sometimes both. Adam was safe, for now. Once he'd regained a little more strength, things could still get problematical unless I tracked down Bran. "Do you know where Bran took the new wolves?" I asked, shutting the back hatch of the van. Carl hadn't asked me about Mac. He didn't have a wolf's nose to tell him what was in the tarp, and I decided that Mac could ride with me for a while longer. Bran could decide what to do with his body.
"You don't want to go after him, Mercy," Carl was saying. "Too dangerous. Why don't you come home with me? We'll feed you while you wait."
"How many wolves are left in town?" I asked. "Is there anyone who could resist Adam's wolf?" That was the downside of being dominant. If you did go moonstruck, you took everyone who was less dominant with you. Carl hesitated.
"Adam's pretty weak yet. Bran will be back by dark."
Something hit the door, and we both jumped.
"He took him up to the Lover's Canyon," Carl told me, giving in to the obvious. "Be careful."
"Bran will have control of the new ones," I told him. "I'll be all right."
"I'm not worried about them. You left enemies behind you, girl."
I smiled tightly. "I can't help what I am. If they are my enemies, it was not by my choice.
I know, but they'll still kill you, if they can.
The lovers were a pair of trees that had grown up twined around each other near the entrance to a small canyon about 10 miles north of town. I parked next to a pair of old-style Land Rovers, a nearly new Chevy Tahoe, and a Humvee, the expensive version. Charles, Brand's son, was a financial genius, and the Maroc's pack would never be begging on street corners. When I left here, I'd had $10,000 in a bank account, the result of part of my minimum wage earnings invested by Charles. I stripped off my clothes in the van, jumped out into knee-deep snow, and shut the door. It was colder up in the mountains than it had been in Troy, and the snow had a crust of hard ice crystals that cut into the bare skin of my feet. I shifted as fast as I could. It might have been safer to go as a human, but I didn't have the right kind of clothing on for a winter hike in Montana. I am not absolutely sure there is a right kind of clothing for a winter hike in Montana. Running as a coyote, I don't mind the cold all that much. I'd grown used to city scents and sounds. The forest scents were no less strong, just different. Fir, aspen, and pine instead of exhaust, fried grease, and humans. I heard the distinctive rat-a-tat of a woodpecker, and, faintly, the howl of a wolf, too deep to be that of a timber wolf. The fresh snow, which was still falling, had done a fair job of hiding their tracks, but I could still smell them. Bran and his mate Leah both had brushed against the bough of a white pine. Charles had left tracks where the ground was half sheltered by a boulder. Once my nose drew me to the right places, I could see where the old snow had been broken by paws before the snow had begun, and the tracks weren't difficult to follow. I hesitated when the wolves' tracks began to separate. Bran had taken the new wolves, there seemed to be three of them, while his sons, Charles and Samuel and Leah, Bran's mate, broke off, probably to hunt up game in the hopes of chasing it back to the rest. I needed to find Bran to tell him what had happened, to get his help for Adam, but I followed Sam's trail instead. I couldn't help it. I'd been in love with him since I was 14. Not that I am in love with him now, I assured myself, following his tracks down an abrupt drop and back up to a ridgetop where the snow wasn't as deep because the wind periodically swept it clean. I was only a teenager when I last saw him, I thought. I hadn't spoken to him since then, and he hadn't tried to contact me either. Still, it had been his number I had called for help. I hadn't even thought about calling anyone else. On the tail of that thought, I realized the forest had fallen silent behind me. The winter woods were quiet. The birds, except for a scattering of nuthatches, cedar waxwings, and a few others like the woodpecker I'd heard, had gone south. But there was an ominous quality to the silence behind me that was too heavy to be only winter's stillness. I was being stalked. I didn't look around, nor did I speed up. Werewolves chase things that run from them. I wasn't really frightened. Bran was out there somewhere, and Samuel was even nearer. I could smell the earth and spice musk that belonged to him alone. The wind carried it to me. The tracks I was following had been laid several hours ago. He must have been returning the way he'd come. Otherwise, he'd have been too far away for me to scent. The new wolves were all with Bran, and the one following me was alone. If there had been more than one, I would have heard something, so I didn't have to be worried about the new wolves killing me by mistake because they thought I was a coyote. I didn't think it was Charles stalking me either. It would be beneath his dignity to frighten me on purpose. Samuel liked playing practical jokes, but the wind doesn't lie, and it told me he was somewhere just ahead. I was pretty sure it was Leah. She wouldn't kill me no matter what Carl had implied, not with Bran sure to find out, but she would hurt me if she could, because she didn't like me. None of the women in Bran's pack liked me. The wind carrying Samuel's scent was coming mostly from the west. The trees on that side were young firs, probably regrowing after a fire that must have happened a decade or so in the past. The firs were tucked together in a close-packed blanket that wouldn't slow me at all, but a werewolf was a lot bigger than I. I scratched my ear with a hind foot and used the movement to get a good look behind me. There was nothing to see, so my stalker was far enough away for me to reach the denser trees. I put my foot down and darted for the trees. The wolf behind me howled her hunting song. Instinct takes over when a wolf is on the hunt. Had she been thinking, Leah would never have uttered a sound, because she was immediately answered by a chorus of howls. Most of the wolves sounded like they were a mile or so farther into the mountains. But Samuel answered her call from no more than 100 yards in front of me. I altered my course accordingly, and found my way through the thicket of trees and out the other side where Samuel had been traveling. He stopped dead at my appearance. I suppose he was expecting a deer or elk, not a coyote. Not me. Samuel was big, even for a werewolf. His fur was winter white, and his eyes appeared almost the same shade, an icy white blue, colder than the snow I ran through, all the more startling for the black ring that edged his iris. There was plenty of room for me to dive under his belly and out the other side, leaving him between me and my pursuer. Before he had a chance to do more than give me that first startled look, Leah appeared, a gold and silver huntress, as beautiful as Samuel in her own way, light and fire where he was ice. She saw Samuel and skidded ungracefully to a halt. I suppose she'd been so hot on the chase she hadn't been paying attention to Samuel's call. I could see the instant he realized who I was. He cocked his head, and his body grew still. He recognized me all right, but I couldn't tell how he felt about it. After the space of a deep breath, he turned back to look at Leah. Leah cringed and rolled onto her back. Though as Bran's wife, she should have outranked Samuel. Unimpressed by the show, he curled his lips away from his fangs and growled, a deep rumbling sound that echoed in my chest. It felt just like old times, Samuel protecting me from the rest of the pack. A wolf howled, nearer than before, and Samuel stopped growling long enough to answer. He looked expectantly toward the north, and in a few minutes two wolves came into sight. The first one was the color of cinnamon, with 4 black feet. He was a shade bigger even than Samuel. The second werewolf was considerably smaller. From a distance, he could have passed as one of the wolves that had only this decade begun to return to Montana. His coat was all the shades between white and black, combining to make him appear medium gray. His eyes were pale gold, and the end of his tail was white. Charles, the cinnamon wolf, stopped at the edge of the trees and began to change. He was an oddity among werewolves. A natural-born werewolf, rather than made, the only one of his kind that I have ever heard of. Charles's mother had been a Salish woman, the daughter of a medicine man. She had been dying when Bran came across her shortly after he arrived in Montana. According to my foster mother, who told me the story, Bran had been so struck with her beauty that he couldn't just let her die, so he changed her and made her his mate. I never could wrap my imagination around the thought of Bran being overcome by love at first sight, but maybe he had been different 200 years ago. At any rate, when she became pregnant, she used the knowledge of magic her father had given her to keep from changing at the full moon. Female werewolves cannot have children. The change is too violent to allow the fetus to survive. But Charles's mother, as her father's daughter, had some magic of her own. She managed to carry Charles to term, but was so weakened by her efforts that she died soon after his birth. She left her son with 2 gifts. The first was that he changed easier and faster. The second was a gift for magic that was unusual in werewolves. Bran's pack did not have to hire a witch to clean up after them. They had Charles. Bran, the smaller of the 2 wolves, continued on to where I stood awaiting him. Samuel stepped aside reluctantly, though he was still careful to keep between Leah and me. There was no sense of power about Bran, not like the one his sons and Adam carried. I'm not certain how he contained it. I've been told that sometimes even other werewolves, whose senses are sharper than mine, mistake him for a real wolf or some wolf-dog hybrid to account for his size. I don't know how old he is. All I know is that he was old when he came to this continent to work as a fur trapper in the late 18th century. He'd traveled to this area of Montana with a Welsh cartographer, David Thompson, and settled to live with his Salish mate. He padded up to me and touched his muzzle behind my ear. I didn't have to sink submissively to be lower than he, but I hunched down anyway. He took my nose between his fangs and released it, a welcome and a gentle chiding all in one, though I wasn't certain what he was chiding me for. Once he released me, he stalked past Samuel and stared down at his wife still lying in the snow. She whined anxiously, and he bared his teeth, unappeased. It seemed that even though he'd once asked me to leave, I wasn't to be viewed as fair game. Bran turned his back on her to look at Charles, who had completed his transformation and stood tall and human. Charles's features were pure Salish, as if the only thing that he'd gotten from his father was the ability to change. I've been told that the Native Americans were shy about their bodies. It was certainly true of Charles. He'd used his magic to clothe himself, and stood garbed in fur-lined buckskins that looked as if they had come out of another century. I, like most shapeshifters, was nearly as comfortable naked as clothed, except in the middle of November, high up in the Rockies of Montana, with a chill Canadian wind blowing from the northwest and the temperature beginning to drop as the snow quit falling at last. And as soon as Charles started to speak, I was going to have to become human so I could talk to him.
"My father bids you welcome to the territory of the Maroc," Charles said, his voice carrying the flat tones of his mother's people, with just a hint of the Welsh lilt Bran no longer spoke with unless he was really angry. "He wonders, however, why you have chosen now to come."
I took human form, quickly kicked snow away from me, then knelt to keep myself lower than Bran. I sucked in my breath at the chill of the wind and the snow under my shins. Samuel moved between me and the worst of the wind. It helped, but not enough. "I came on pack business," I told them. Charles raised his eyebrows.
"You come smelling of blood and death."
Charles had always had a good nose. I nodded. "I brought the Columbia Basin Alpha here. He's been badly wounded. I also brought the body of another wolf, hoping someone here could tell me how he died and who killed him." Bran made a soft sound, and Charles nodded.
"Tell us what is necessary now. You can give us the details later."
So I told them what I knew as succinctly as possible, beginning with Mac's story, as he had told it to me, and ending with Mac's death, Adam's wounds, and Jesse's kidnapping. By the time I was finished, my teeth were chattering, and I could barely understand myself. Even when I shifted back into coyote form, I couldn't quite warm up. Bran glanced at Samuel, who gave a woof and took off at a dead run.
"Bran will finish the hunt with the new ones," Charles told me. "It is their first hunt and should not be interrupted. Samuel is going back to take care of Adam. He'll take a shorter route than the automobiles can manage, so he'll be there before us. I'll ride back with you and take care of your dead."
On the tail end of Charles's words, Bran trotted off into the forest without looking at me again. Leah rose from her submissive pose, growled at me like it was my fault she'd gotten herself in trouble, and followed Bran. Charles, still in human form, strode off in the direction of the cars. He wasn't talkative at the best of times, and with me still four-footed and mute, he didn't bother to say anything at all. He waited politely on the passenger side of the van while I transformed again and dove into my clothes. He didn't object to my driving, as Samuel would have. I'd never seen Charles drive a car. He preferred to ride horseback or run as a wolf. He climbed into the passenger seat and glanced once behind him at the tarped body. Without commenting, he belted himself in. When we got back to the motel, I pulled in at the office door. Carl was in the office with a red-eyed young woman who must be the missing Marley, though I couldn't see the six-year-old I'd known.
"Mercedes needs a room," Charles told them.
Carl didn't question him, just handed me a key.
"This is on the side away from the road, as far from number one as we get."
I looked down at the number 18 stamped on the key. "Don't you know that you're not supposed to put the room number on the key anymore?" I asked.
"Well, we don't have much trouble with burglary," Carl said, smiling. "Besides, I know you spent a couple of years working here. Except for number one, there are only three different locks for all the rooms."
I smiled at him and tossed the key up once and caught it. "True enough." Charles opened the door for me as we left.
"If you'll get your luggage and give me your car keys, I'll take care of the body."
I must have looked surprised.
"Don't worry," he told me dryly. "I'll have Carl drive."
No luggage, I told him. I pulled out my keys and gave them to him, but caught his hand before he pulled away. Mac was a good man, I told him. I don't know why I said it. Charles didn't touch anyone casually. I had always thought he rather despised me, though he treated me with the same remote courtesy he used with everyone else. But he put his free hand on the back of my head and pulled my forehead briefly against his shoulder.
I'll take care of him, he promised as he stepped back.
His full name was Alan Mackenzie Frazier. He nodded.
I'll see that he is treated well.
Thank you, I told him, then turned and walked toward my room before I could start to cry again.
Chapter 6.
There was a pile of National Geographics and a paperback mystery stacked neatly on the nightstand. As I recall, the reading material was put there originally to make up for the absence of a TV. When I'd cleaned rooms here, you couldn't get reception so far in the mountains. Now there was a dish on top of the motel, and a small TV positioned so you could watch it either from the bed or the small table in the kitchenette. I wasn't interested in watching old reruns or soap operas, so I flipped desultorily through the magazines. They looked familiar. Maybe they were the same stack that had been here when I'd last cleaned this room. The newest one was dated May of 1976, so it was possible. Or maybe random stacks of National Geographics have a certain sameness gained from years of appearing in waiting rooms. I wondered if Jesse were lying in a hospital somewhere. My mind flashed to a morgue, but I brought it back under control. Panic wouldn't help anyone. I was doing the best that I could. I picked up the lone book and sat on the bed. The cover was not prepossessing, being a line drawing of a Wisconsin-style barn, but I opened it anyway and started reading. I closed it before I'd read more than the first sentence. I couldn't bear sitting here alone doing nothing. I left the room. It was colder than it had been, and all I had was my T-shirt, so I ran to number one. I had the key in the pocket of my jeans, but when I tried the door, it opened. Adam lay on top of the bed on his side, his muzzle wrapped with a businesslike strap. Samuel was bent over him wearing a pair of jeans, plastic gloves, and nothing else. It was a measure of my concern for Adam that my eyes didn't linger. Charles, leaning against the wall, stared at me, but said nothing.
"Shut the door," Samuel snapped without looking up. "Damn it, Mercy. You should have set the brake before you threw him in the car and drove all day. You of all people know how fast we heal. I'll have to re-break his leg."
Samuel had never yelled at me before. He was the least volatile male werewolf I'd ever met. "I don't know how to set bones," I said, wrapping my arms around myself. But he was right. I knew werewolves heal incredibly fast. I just hadn't thought about what that meant as far as broken bones were concerned. I hadn't even known his leg was broken. I'd been stupid. I should have just called Daryl.
"How much training does it take to set a leg?" Samuel continued with barely a pause. "All you have to do is pull it straight."
His hands were gentle as they stretched out Adam's leg.
"He'd have had someone with medic training in his pack. You could have called for help if you didn't have the guts for it yourself."
Then to Adam he said,
"Brace yourself."
From my position by the door, I couldn't see what he did, but I heard a bone snap, and Adam jerked and made a noise I never want to hear again.
"I was worried that someone from his pack was involved in the attack," I whispered. "Adam was unconscious. I couldn't ask him. And they don't have anyone strong enough to control Adam's wolf."
Samuel glanced back at me, then swore.
"If all you can do is snivel, then get the hell out of here."
Despite his condition, Adam growled, swiveling his head to look at Samuel.
"I'm sorry," I said,
and left, closing the door tightly behind me. I'd spent 20 minutes staring at the first page of the mystery when someone knocked on the door. My nose told me it was Samuel, so I didn't answer right away.
"Mercy."
His voice was soft, just as I remembered it, with just a touch of Celt. If I left early in the morning, I could get a head start on looking for Jesse, I thought, staring at the door. Someone else could take Adam back when he was ready to travel. If I left early enough, I could avoid talking to Samuel altogether.
"Mercy, I know you're listening to me."
I stared at the door, but didn't say anything.
I didn't want to talk to him. He'd been right. I had been useless, subjecting Adam to a 6-hour drive because of a chance remark of Daryl's, a remark that I was beginning to think meant nothing. Of course, as I told Samuel earlier, the pack would have had to bring Adam to Montana, or at least sent for a dominant until Adam could control himself, but they would have set his broken leg immediately. Daryl and the pack could be out looking for Jesse with Adam safely on the road to recovery if I hadn't been so stupid. In my own world of engines and CV joints, I'd grown used to being competent. If Adam had been a car, I'd have known what to do. But in Aspen Creek, I'd always been not quite good enough. Some things, it seemed, hadn't changed.
Mercy, look, I'm sorry. If you didn't know first aid and you couldn't trust his pack, there's nothing else you could have done.
His voice was soft and sweet as molasses. But my mother once told me that you had to trust that the first thing out of a person's mouth was truth. After they have a chance to think about it, they'll change what they say to be more socially acceptable. Something they think you'll be happier with. Something that will get the results they want. I knew what he wanted. What he had always wanted from me, even if, while he had been working on Adam's injuries, Samuel himself had forgotten.
"Adam tore a strip off me for being so hard on you," he said, his voice coaxing. "He was right. I was mad because I don't like hurting someone unnecessarily, and I took it out on you. Can I come in and talk to you instead of the door?"
I rubbed my face tiredly. I wasn't 16 anymore to run away from difficult things, no matter how attractive that option was. There were, I thought reluctantly, things I needed to say to him as well.
"All right," he said. "All right, Mercy. I'll see you in the morning."
He had turned around and was already walking away when I opened the door. "Come in," I said, and shivered when the wind blew through my shirt. "But you'd better hurry. It's colder than a witch's britches out there." He came back and stomped his feet hard on the mat, leaving behind clumps of snow, before stepping inside my room. He took off his coat and set it on the table near the door, and I saw he'd found a shirt somewhere. They kept stashes of clothes around town, in case someone needed to dress quickly. Unisex things mostly, like jeans, t-shirts, and sweats. The t-shirt he wore was a little small and clung to him like a second skin. If he'd had an extra ounce of fat or a little less muscle, it would have looked stupid, but he was built like a Chippendales dancer. His body was lovely, but I don't know if anyone else would have called him handsome. He certainly didn't have Adam's strikingly beautiful features. Sam's eyes were deeply set, his nose was too long, his mouth too wide. His coloring in human form was much less striking than his wolf. Light blue-gray eyes and brown hair streaked just a bit from the sun. Looking at his face, I wasn't objective enough to decide how attractive he was. He was just Sam, who had been my friend, my defender, and my sweetheart. I glanced away from his face, dropping my own so that he couldn't read my anger and whatever other emotion was hammering at me until I'd gotten it under control. If he read the wrong thing into it, that wasn't my fault. I hadn't let him in to argue with him.
"I didn't think you were going to talk to me," he said with a shadow of his usual warm smile in his voice.
"Me either," I agreed grimly to my shoes. I wasn't going to get through this if I had to look at him. "But I owe you an apology, too."
"No."
His tone was wary. Apparently he was too smart to believe my submissive gaze.
"You have nothing to be sorry for. I shouldn't have snapped your nose off earlier."
"It's all right," I told him. "You were probably right. I found Mac dead and Adam almost in the same shape, and I panicked." I walked to the bed and sat on it, because it was as far away from him as I could get in the motel room. Only then did I dare to look at him again. "My apology is years overdue. I should have talked to you before I left. I should have told you I'd decided to go to Portland. But I was afraid I might do something stupid like shoot you, or worse, cry." But he didn't need to know that part. The humor that usually touched his face leaked away, leaving behind neutral wariness, as if he were watching for a trap.
"My father told me he'd spoken to you and persuaded you to go to your mother's house instead of running off with me," he said.
"How long did you wait for me?" After Bran had caught us necking in the woods and told me he was sending me to Portland, Samuel had decided that he'd take me away with him instead. I was supposed to sneak out and meet him in the woods a mile or so from my house. But the Maroc knew. He was like that. He told me why Samuel wanted to take me as his mate, and it hadn't been for any reason I could accept. So while Samuel waited for me, Charles was driving me down to Libby to catch the train to Portland that morning instead. Samuel looked away from me without answering. In his own way, Samuel was the most honorable person I'd ever known, something that made his betrayal hurt worse, because I knew that he'd never meant me to believe he loved me. He told me he would wait for me, and I knew he'd waited long after he'd realized I wasn't going to come. "That's what I thought," I said in a small voice. "Damn it, he shouldn't still affect me this way." I found that I was taking deeper breaths than I normally did, just to breathe in his scent. "I should have told you I'd changed my mind," I told him, clinging by my fingernails to the threads of what I needed to tell him. "I'm sorry for abandoning you without a word. It was neither right nor kind."
"Father told you to go without talking to me again," Samuel said.
He sounded detached, but he turned his back on me and was staring at a damp spot on the rug near his boots. "I am not of his pack," I snapped. "That has always been made perfectly clear to me. It means I didn't have to obey Bran then. I shouldn't have, and I knew it at the time. I'm sorry. Not for leaving. That was the right decision. But I should have told you what I was doing. I was a coward."
"My father told me what he told you."
His voice started calmly enough, but there was a tinge of anger weaving itself through his words as he continued.
"But you should have known all of that already. I didn't hide anything."
There was no defensiveness in his voice or in his posture. He really didn't understand what he'd done to me, as stupid as that made him in my eyes. It was still good, somehow, to know that the hurt he'd caused me had been unintentional. He turned, his eyes met mine, and I felt the zing that had once been as familiar as his face. Part of it was attraction, but part of it was the power of a dominant wolf. The attraction brought me to my feet and halfway across the room before I realized what I was doing. "Look, Samuel," I said, coming to an abrupt halt before I touched him. "I'm tired. It's been a rough day. I don't want to fight with you over things that are long past."
"All right."
His voice was soft, and he gave a little nod to himself.
"We can talk more tomorrow."
He put his coat back on, started for the door, then turned back.
"I almost forgot. Charles and Carl took the body."
"Mac," I told him sharply.
"Mac," he said, gentling his tone.
I wished he hadn't done that, because his sympathy brought tears to my eyes.
"They took Mac to our clinic and brought back your van. Charles gave me the keys. He would have returned them himself, but you left the room too quickly. I told him I was coming to deliver an apology, so he gave them to me."
"Did he lock the van?" I asked. "I've a pair of guns in there loaded for werewolves." Mention of the guns reminded me of something else, something odd. "Oh, and there's a tranquilizer dart of some sort that I found near Adam when I moved him."
"The van's locked," he said. "Charles found the dart and left it at the lab because he said it smelled of silver and Adam. Now that I know where you found it, I'll make sure to look it over carefully."
"Mac said someone was using him to experiment on," I told him. "They'd found some drugs that worked on werewolves," he said. Samuel nodded.
"I remember you telling us that."
He held out my keys, and careful not to touch his hand, I took them from him. He smiled as if I'd done something interesting, and I realized I shouldn't have been so careful. If I had felt nothing for him, touching his hand wouldn't have bothered me. Living among normal humans, I'd forgotten how difficult it was to hide anything from werewolves.
"Good night, Mercy," he said.
Then he was gone, and the room felt emptier for his leaving it. I'd better go in the morning, I thought, as I listened to the snow squeak under his feet as he walked away. I was busy reading page 14 for the third time when someone else knocked on the door.
"I brought dinner," said a man's pleasant tenor.
I set the book down and opened the door. A sandy-haired young man with a nondescript face held a plastic tray loaded with two plastic-wrapped sub-sandwiches, a pair of styrofoam cups of hot chocolate, and a dark blue winter jacket. Maybe it was the food, but it occurred to me that if Bran looked that much like the cliché of a delivery boy, it was probably on purpose. He liked to be unobtrusive. He gave me a small smile when I didn't step away from the door right away.
Charles told me that Adam is going to be fine, and Samuel made a fool of himself.
Samuel apologized, I told him, stepping back and letting him into the room. The kitchenette had a two-burner stove, six-pack-sized fridge, and a small formica-covered table with two chairs. After tossing the coat on the bed, Bran set the tray on the table and rearranged the contents until there was a sandwich and cup on each side.
Charles told me that you didn't have a coat, so I brought one. I also thought you might like something to eat, he said. Then we can discuss what we're to do with your Alpha and his missing daughter.
He sat down on one side and gestured for me to take the other seat. I sat and realized I hadn't eaten anything all day. I hadn't been hungry. I still wasn't. True to his word, he didn't talk while he ate and I picked. The sandwich tasted of refrigerator, but the cocoa was rich with marshmallows and real vanilla. He ate faster than I did, but waited patiently for me to finish. The sandwich was one of those huge subs built to feed you for a week. I ate part of it and wrapped the rest in the plastic it had come in. Bran had eaten all of his, but werewolves need a lot of food. My foster mother had liked to say, "Never starve a werewolf or he might ask you to join him for a lunch." She'd always pat her husband on the head afterward, even if he was in human form. I don't know why I thought of that right then, or why the thought tried to bring tears to my eyes. My foster parents were both of them almost 17 years dead. She died trying to become a werewolf because, she told me, every year she got older and he didn't. There are a lot fewer women who are moon-called, because they just don't survive the change as well. My foster father died from grief a month later. I'd been 14. I took a sip of cocoa and waited for Bran to talk. He sighed heavily and leaned back in the chair, balancing it on two legs, his own legs dangling in the air. "People don't do that," I told him. He raised an eyebrow.
"Do what?"
"Balance like that, not unless they're teenage boys showing off for their girlfriends." He brought all four legs back on the floor abruptly.
"Thank you."
Bran liked to appear as human as possible, but his gratitude was a little sharp. I took a hasty sip of cocoa so he wouldn't see my amusement. He put his elbows on the table and folded his hands.
"What are your intentions now, Mercy?"
"What do you mean?"
"Adam's safe and healing. We'll find out how your young friend was killed. What are you planning to do?"
"Bran is scary. He's a little psychic. At least that's what he says if you ask. What that means is that he can talk to any werewolf he knows, mind to mind. That's why Charles was able to be his spokesperson out in the woods. Bran uses that ability, among others, to control the North American packs. He claims it is all one way, that he can make people hear him, but not the other way around. The pack whisperers say he has other abilities, too, but no one knows exactly what they are. The most common rumor is that he really can read minds. Certainly, he always knew who was responsible for what mischief around the town. My foster mother always laughed and said it was his reputation for knowing everything that allowed him to appear infallible. All he had to do was walk through the room and see who looked guiltiest when they saw him. Maybe she was right, but I tried looking innocent the next time, and it didn't work. "I'm leaving in the morning." Early, I thought, to get away without talking to Samuel again, but also to get started looking for Jesse. Bran shook his head and frowned.
"Afternoon."
I felt my eyebrows rise. "Well," I said gently, "if you knew what I was going to be doing, why didn't you just tell me instead of asking?" He gave me a small smile.
"If you wait until afternoon, Adam will be ready to travel, and Samuel should know something about how your young man, Alan Mackenzie Fraser, died. He's staying up tonight to perform the autopsy and run tests in the lab."
He leaned forward.
It's not your fault, Mercy. I spilled the cocoa all down the front of my T-shirt.
Shh, I bit off the word. Bran didn't approve of swearing. You can read minds.
I know the way your mind works, Bran said, with a little smile that managed to be not quite smug. But he was quick enough retrieving a roll of paper towels stored under the sink and handed them to me as I held my shirt away from my body. The cocoa was still hot, though not scalding. As I mopped myself up at the sink, he continued.
Unless you've changed more than I can believe, if something happens, if someone gets hurt, it must be your fault. I had the story from Adam, as far as he knows it, and it had nothing to do with you.
Ha! Huh, you can read minds. He's in wolf form and can't talk, I said.
I'd done the best I could with the shirt, but I wished I had an extra change of clothing. Bran smiled.
He's not now. Sometimes the change helps us heal faster. Usually we change from human to wolf, but the other way works as well. He was not happy with Samuel.
Bran's smile deepened.
He spent his first words chewing him out, told him that second-guessing the man in the field was an amateur's mistake. He said he'd rather not have someone who didn't know what they were doing mucking about with his wounds. He also said that you had more guts than sense sometimes.
Bran tipped his styrofoam cup in my direction.
As it happens, I agree, which is why I asked Adam to keep an eye on you for me when you moved into his territory.
Ah, I thought, and tried not to look as devastated as I felt. So Adam had been ordered to look after me? I had rather thought that the odd relationship we had was based on something else. Knowing that Bran had told him to watch me changed the shading of